and gentlemen, this is Henrik. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's always a pleasure to have you here. Our guest is Rob Kievsky. He's behind a blog called Mind Weapons in Ragnarök. Rob Kievsky specializes in the theory and practice of finding, describing, and correcting the deficits or the major problems of our modern lives. Examples of these deficit areas includes American child rearing or lack thereof, compulsory automobile ownership, education from K through college undergrad, and movement deficit, especially in adults, since most of our jobs forces us to be sedentary. In his bio, he writes, "Our biggest deficit is the idiocracy dystopia. If we fix the education or consciousness deficit, then the other deficits will fix themselves as a matter of course." Now, this show is going to be about one of our worst enemies, bad parenting. And we are also going to talk about if it's necessary for us to adapt a mercantile approach when it comes to business, running businesses, and adapting an ethnocentric approach like all other mercantile groups have done. It's really only us that have an inclusive, diversity-oriented business model where we even actively keep our own out and favor others. If the marketplace is the new battlefield of today, then we have to learn how to fight and realize that so much of the ills made against us have been financial. We'll talk about all of this and the nature of a merchant guild where we can share trade secrets in order to become competitive and fight back. We have Rob Kievsky with us. We briefly met at NPI actually last year. It's good to speak with you again, Rob. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much, Henrik. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Now, we are going to talk. We have two major issues here addressing today that you see that we struggle with: bad parenting, and of course also the issue of creating a merchant guild, pretty much. It's a very interesting discussion. We spoke briefly about this when we met last year, and I think you have some really cool ideas. I'm really looking forward to hearing more about this. But before we go there, what do you think our audience should know about you, Rob?
Well, I've been in this for 16 years, since 2000, and my function has basically been to what do we do? Like, what do we do to make things better for ourselves? We're being... The left has outlawed the right, the organic, you know, political right of that actual white people, not, you know, neoconservatives, but actual real people, flesh and blood, middle American people, what kind of right they would have. That has been criminalized, and not criminalized in the sense, in the formal legal sense, because we have a constitution, we have a First Amendment, but they, you know, they find a loophole. I mean, there's a Jewish thing, show me a law and I'll find a loophole. And so what they do, and I don't want to scare people off, but this is realistic, they will, if you are a right-wing activist, a middle American right-wing activist, they will, you know, try to get a picture of you and get your information.
Sure.
And then put it on a website. And then when you apply for a job, a human resources person Googles you, they find you. So I'm what they call a Google felon, or what I made the term Google felon, right? And the terrible thing is then you can't get a job at a corporation, which people expect to get. That's how you support your family. And the white nationalist movement, the better sort of people who join the movement are the family men. They have kids and they're worried about, you know, their white children and in this world that really hates us. And so they join the movement and then they get doxxed and they can't support their family and, you know, they don't have legitimacy in the eyes of the wife. You know, there's a chance of divorce and then the kids grow up without the fatherly influence and God knows what happens to them. You know, all the things you were trying to prevent happening to them ends up happening to the children. Now, I was lucky. I mean, I married to a Russian woman and she's very strong. But I mean, they've definitely beaten her up really hard for being married to me. And it was, you know, no fault of her own. I wasn't a white nationalist when we got married. You know, I came in after. But anyways, she ran for a political office and her opposition, dug up the information on me and put it on his Facebook. And then the, you know, mass media picked it up and doxed me all over the place and like I'm some kind of bad person. You know, and the truth is, I mean, I put my writings openly on the internet. I didn't hide it from anyone. I didn't say you can't read this. And a lot of people in this country would have benefited from reading my blog because, you know, I said like the biggest problems in this country are, you know, children being sat in front of the television and being fed high fructose corn syrup, you know, and video games, right? I mean, I cut right to the chase, and I said it constantly. And so, I mean, any accusation that I'm doing anything bad to the colored races is insane, because they could have read my blog and could have benefited greatly. You know, there's no way I did any harm to anyone, you know, and I could have been had benefit.
Yep.
But
your crime, Rob, sorry to interrupt you, your crime was the fact that you care about your own people and want to see them well off.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, I didn't put restrictions. People of any race could have read my blog.
Sure,
I didn't, you know, I didn't password protect it against the other race, right?
Right.
Yeah. And so
do you want to tell us what the blog was, or do you want to remain?
Sure. Mind Weapons in Ragnarok.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and the whole idea of that was, white people have mostly known how to wage conflict, to do the business of conflict. We've done with violence, with guns, with bows and arrows and swords, hot lead and cold steel, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's many ways to wage conflict. There's finance war, there's mind war, culture war, and whites, you know, we haven't known that. And so you get these guys taking a gun to a mind war, they're going to lose, right? Because the mind war is much bigger. It's the world of computers and high finance and stuff has made it, you know, the bankers are really the biggest generals in the war. They win no matter which side wins, right?
And that's correct. Yeah.
We got to figure out. So that is the conflict we have to wage, you know, not the hot lead and cold steel. So that's why I called it mind weapons. In Ragnarok, Ragnarok is the Norse apocalypse, basically.
Mm.
Yeah, when there's the battles and the end of the world, and then the cycle happens all over again. I don't know, but perhaps you could explain Ragnarok better than me.
No, that's just about it. It's the culmination of everything at the end of time, basically, where all the gods come out and fight, and the world ends. Yeah, you're right.
Right. So the idea of mind weapons in Ragnarok is, how do we live in Ragnarok with some dignity? You know, how do we not get paused? How do we get? That's really all it was about.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's the idea of that title, is that we're in this horrible situation, but we can make it better by basically a Machiavellian understanding that the only thing that matters is winning, and the idea that we got to search for trade secrets and cheat codes in this world, and there's tons of them.
Well, isn't Rob, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that really where the battle is these days in terms of even as war is concerned, right? I mean, we do have nations making war still, but where some of the biggest battles goes on these days is these transnational globalized corporations that make more money than some countries do, and the world of battle, of guns and ammo and all that stuff, has moved into the realm of the business world to a certain extent, right? That's where the fight is these days, and we are kind of lagging behind on that regard. We're not understanding that we are being conquered by people who see business as a warfare strategy, right?
Right, and you know what? As soon as we figure that out, then we're going to neutralize the advantage of the people who are doing this to us. Because when people en masse, you know, the millions of people understand how to actually wage conflict at all in the business war, it doesn't matter if everyone's contribution is minute. It'll all add up really quick. You know, we can reverse this thing really fast once we know what's going on, once Aryan Skynet is self-aware. So we're really meandering down some paths here, but
oh, it's all good. It's all good. When would you say that this started, right? I think we talked about this, and it was an interesting little point here, that in the Middle Ages and later, you know, from the, 1400s, 15, maybe 16, we were outmaneuvered by the merchant guilds, right?
Yeah, well, as Matt, you know who Matt Parrott is, right?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, I greatly admire Matt Parrott. I think he's one of the geniuses of this movement. He's really the most, he's brilliant. And you know, we've been going back and forth, you know, and so he took my ideas, And he summarized it like this. He said, white people are still like Conan the Barbarian. You know, we don't have 3,000 years of like written culture behind us. You know, 500 years ago, we were still like Braveheart, you know, fighting with bows and arrows and swords and stuff. And whereas the Chinese, the Hindus, and the Jews, you know, have millennia of written tradition and bureaucracy. So they have evolved to be very good at a managerial culture, you know, at mastering the details, right? Whereas white people are still Conan the Barbarian. You know, we don't have time. We don't want to deal with those details, right? But we have to force ourselves into those to deal with the details. We have to force ourselves to master dry material. And that's how, you know, that's how we neutralize the advantage. And so that made me realize, well, okay, my idea is that if we kind of use the Indians and the Chinese and their, you know, the convenience store businesses and liquor stores and, you know, the different kinds of business they run, the small business thing they do, that's kind of like our training dummies, right? So if we go and compete with them on that level for a generation or two and really get good at it, then we'll be ready to take the conflict to, you know, the Jews and their banking stuff, you know? And it might not even take a whole generation. It could take, you know, 10 or 20 years. I mean, because things go so fast these days.
Would you say there is a reluctancy by whites and European Americans, Europeans to adopt these kinds of service jobs, that somehow it's kind of, we seek for a higher education and we seek to go for a, you know, corporate job of some other level. And, but now when that's in some countries are kind of thinning out and we're also being discriminated against in the workforce by the fact that we are whites, is that dynamic changing, do you think?
I'm trying to change it. That's why we're talking here. I want people to take action. I want people to get in touch with me and to take, you know, with the idea that they are going to go to the small business, find the small business development center in their area, I'm talking about in the United States, and, you know, find some business that they can get into and start doing it, start becoming, you know, to become a merchant. And the Small Business Administration, Small Business Development Center, they'll help you, you know, and I'll help you, at least by phone or something. But yeah, so it's just something we're not used to. We weren't given that. That wasn't a tradition, but it's something we have to do now, you know, because why should all these foreigners own all the 7-Elevens, right? And they take all the money and they send it back home to India or Pakistan or Bangladesh. We need to own those businesses and support our local communities. Those convenience stores, they don't sponsor the Little League, you know? They don't care. They don't care about the locals at all. They're just there to suck money out of the community. And, I mean, and I'm not saying to do anything, to be hostile to them or anything. I'm saying to compete with them in business and just kind of elbow them out, mm-hmm. You know? It's all fair, you know? And just that way, we need to say, you know, we should be earning that money. We should be getting that money so we can raise weaponized white children, and we'll come to that later. But we need to have affordable family formation. We can't afford to have families anymore. You know, our professional jobs were taken away. Our factory jobs were taken away. People have nothing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, the only people who have children now are the ones on welfare. And white people, too. But, I mean, I see white people reproducing, but, you know, not the ones that should be.
No, that's true. Well, you know, I think many of them are also incentivized when it comes into our countries by our government to get ahead, to get these stores and kiosks and corner shops. And, you know, we have tons of these in Sweden. Almost every one of these little kiosks or obviously if it's a kebab or pizza, you know, place or something like that. But I'm thinking that our government must be granting them some kind of money to get these facilities, to get started and everything, because I don't know how they would do it.
Well, you know what, though?
You know?
That's we shouldn't even be mad about that. That's not the problem. The problem is that our people are not contesting for those businesses at all. We should be contesting for it.
And don't think they are? But they're not given the same. That's what I'm saying. They're given a leg up as opposed to us, right? They're given an advantage above us.
We're not even trying. Look, if we're not even trying, then what the, and there are, you can get a leg, you know, they can, will give you a leg up. If you live in a poor area, there's programs that'll give you a leg up. I'll tell you something that happens is that they'll have loans available for minorities and stuff, but then not enough minorities will apply for those loans. So they're stuck with all this, these loans that they got to make and they can't make. So then they change the criteria. They say, okay, this is a poor area, and let's remove all the racial and gender and you know, requirements, and just say you live in this poor area. Oh, and even the income requirement, right? You live in this poor area, and you got a viable business, we'll give you a loan, right? That's it.
Have they have they ever done that, actually? Backed off on some of the, like, restriction over the fact that your name must be Hernandez or, you know, whatever, or Muhammad to get the deal?
Let's say that I know for sure, yes.
Right.
But I'm talking about something that actually is true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's one of the things that's happening. A lot of the immigrants come into the country, and the money comes in, and they spend it all, right? And then they got to get another loan, or they got to get bailed out, or whatever. They go out of business. So the problem is not that the immigrants are given the leg up. The problem is that white Americans aren't even trying to do it. That's the real problem. And once you go down that path, there's a lot of help. I mean, the U.S. government has an interest in more Americans, you know, doing small businesses, because small businesses keep society going. You know, the people who own small businesses are kind of responsible for the community. You know, they keep the trains running on time, so to speak.
Yeah.
And the government understands that. You know, I think the U.S. government, they understand racial realities, but they can't officially understand it. You know what I mean? But they have an interest in society running properly. Otherwise, it makes them look bad. You know, Camden makes them look bad. Detroit makes them look bad. They want less of that. They want social cohesion. They want society to function. Because it helps their legitimacy. And that's an opportunity for white people to, you know, start a business and work with the Small Business Administration, the Small Business Development Center people, and, you know, and they'll give you all kinds of trade secrets and cheat codes, and they'll hook you up with other people. And the immigrants who have these businesses, you can very often find that, you know, they're going out of business because they're mismanaging it, and you could buy it for pennies on the dollar. You know,
mm-hmm.
You can look and
right.
See if it's got a good market, and it's just being mismanaged. That's a great opportunity, you know, for kind of vulture capitalism.
Tell us a bit more about what jobs do you think that people should go for, or perhaps we should actually talk first about what strategy you think people should adopt if they're in this position of either they don't have a good job, or maybe they don't have a job at all. They want to seek to do something different or expand into this area that you're talking about. What should they do? Where should they begin?
I would say they should find a liquor store that's owned by an older white person, and he wants to sell that. Someday he wants to take it off his hands. You know, wants someone to take it off his hands, and he might sell to a Pakistani, right? And, you know, you work for him and you say, look, I'll get a loan. I'll buy it from you, you know, and it'll still be in the hands of, you know, a local person instead of a foreigner. That would be one way.
Mm-hmm.
It's all connections, right?
Yep.
If you're going to go to college, major in business. And if you can get, you would need to start a small business. You really only need like $30,000 or $40,000 down payment. Right, which is about 20%, and you can get a business for like $200,000, like a convenience store. There's businesses you can get for $100,000. You know, you can start like a livery company or a taxi company for like $100,000. So there's all kinds of stuff out there, and that's something, you know. But that's what you got to talk about with someone like me or with the local Small Business Administration, and you got to talk to people around town. You know, if everyone around town is saying we really need a we really need a taxi company, or we really need a mini mart in this area. Oh, I wish we had a mini mart. Don't take their word for it exclusively, but that will give you an hour. You see people on the street. What does this town need as far as a business? Ask 100 people, you know? And if they all say we need a mini mart, there you go. There's your business. There's where you start. And then you can the Small Business Administration people will, do a geographical information systems for business analysis, and they'll give you an idea if, you know, a mini mart will actually work in this area based on the demographic information, all the number crunching they do. And this is the stuff we got to learn for ourselves too. So, and then, you know, so assuming you have a down payment of 30 or 40,000, you know, you buy the property and maybe the inventory if there's an existing place, or you start up a new one, and you know, you got your mini mart and or a coin op laundromat, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ask people around, just, you need a coin op laundromat? Yeah, we really need one. And so, you know, you put one in, or you find someone. Even better is you find someone who's sick of, I think the best thing to do is find someone who's sick of owning the business. You know, you look at his numbers, and you have the SBA look at his numbers, and of course he's probably socking a lot of cash away. So you find out how much cash are you socking away, try to get a good number on that. And
so kind of develop a, it could be a good tip to actually develop somewhat of a relationship with some of these people that own these businesses, right?
Oh, yeah.
Get to know them a little bit. Yeah.
Oh, they'll tell you everything once you're friends. You know, over a few beers, they'll tell you everything.
Right.
Right.
So are there, now I'm a little bit uncertain about this area actually, but obviously there have to be town hall meetings, the Chamber of Commerce or whatever. Maybe that's too grand of a term in a small town, but you know.
I recommend buying an existing business rather than starting something totally new.
I'm just saying, if people can actually find out, get if there are meetings by business people in the town that you're in, that way could be a way to figure out what is needed or what the lingo of the town is. Do you see what I'm saying? Get a building a network in that way, right?
You're better off just asking ordinary people on the street what's needed.
Right. Okay.
Or, you know, say you got your eye on a coin op laundry. You know, the guy has You know the guy wants to sell. He's, you know, so there's a lot of people who own businesses that are sick of it. They just want to pass it to someone else. So you sit there and you watch people. You know, take a book but then take note of how many loads of laundry someone does, you know, and the people do on that day, and you get an idea of how much revenue they pull in a day. And then you talk to the small business owner and he'll tell you his bills, you know, he'll tell you his water bill, his electric bill, his rent, right? And you just do the numbers. You see if it's actually going to be profitable. And you ask him how much he's drawn for himself. You know, he might be running to the casino all the time, blowing all his money, you know, blowing up his business. A lot of them blow up. There's a lot of people who are messed up who own businesses. So there's tremendous opportunities for vulture capitalism in the small business arena. Tremendous opportunities everywhere.
Right.
So you just get to know them, you know, kind of, you know. And then you offer to buy their business from them, you know, basically to pay off their debts and maybe give them $5,000 to walk away, and then it's yours. If you already know the numbers, they have an established customer base, you're all set, you're in business. And so a lot of the business people, you know, they take the money that should be going to pay bills, and they're spending it on alcohol or cocaine or, you know, casinos, right?
Jeez.
So, yeah. So that's why there's tremendous opportunity. It's just a matter of getting to know the people who do it. And they don't necessarily go to Chamber of Commerce meetings, you know. You're more likely to meet them at the bar or the casino.
Mm-hmm. True. Yeah, true. Okay, one aspect of all of this that I think is important, too, is this idea of a mentality when this is being done, right? Who are they really working for, people, right? Someone would obviously do this not only for themselves, but for their family, to take care of themselves, to take care of their family. But it's this aspect that what you're talking about is also a different strategy and approach to the fact that this is something that you're seeking to spread among our people as a way of them understanding that we're doing this together also. We're pulling this together so that we will establish a base of not only business, but resources. Maybe even at the end of this, a network where we help each other out. There's much more to a merchant guild than just running a business. I think we briefly spoke about this last time, but the comparison of almost like a type of a secret society in the way that some of the Masonic lodges have been organized is actually a very good structure for something like this, isn't it?
Right. But first I want to mention real quick, when you're a merchant, you get more familial time. The family works together. Right. So, you know, the wife runs the register, you know, the kid mops the floor, you know what I mean? And dad watches over everything. And in the back, the kid is studying, doing his homework. You can bring in a tutor, you know what I mean? So the child bonds more when you have a merchant family, the child bonds with the parents instead of with the peers. And that's the key to successful child raising. is that making sure the kid bonds with the parents more than the peers. And having your own business, a family business, is the way to make that happen. So, and then with the guild thing, all right, the point of the guild is to minimize risk, right? So that you don't, you're not going to go out of business. The business is going to be successful. And that's just a matter of not making stupid mistakes. So, and then when the guild will also hopefully get enough money to be our own bank and to finance new businesses that we make sure don't fail, because we'll have the skills to understand, is this a business going to work here? And we're going to work with the person very closely while he's, has a loan from us, so that, he's not going to fail and he's not going to spend the money at the casino. And so we'll have the expertise. You want to have a library of trade secrets, and you want to have subject area experts so that we know, yes, a laundromat will work in this town on this street, or a taxi company will work in this area, and you do this, and this. So we want to take out the risk. Anybody can start a business, and that's why a lot of people fail. A lot of people just go into it and they do a hobby business that will never work, or they get a good business going but they mess it up,
mm-hmm.
because they
right.
don't know what they're doing. They make stupid mistakes. So we want to eliminate the stupid mistakes. And the great thing about the Guild of Merchants is, when someone doesn't have a good character, we'll figure it out right away. We'll figure it out before they get to the level of manager. We'll figure it out when they work for us, when they don't show up for work, or they pilfer or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a way to naturally filter out the defective losers, and only have good people.
Now, obviously the guild structure rose up in medieval times in Central Europe somewhere, but is that, as a structure, is that actually in place today? Do you know much about what's going on within the guild world today? Or has it been replaced by something else these days?
There's very few civic organizations left. Because they're not allowed to have a racial basis, then nobody wants to participate. I mean, people don't want to contribute to a good that's going to go to a different race than them.
Right.
Right?
Mm.
So, who wants to join the Lions Club if it allows in, alien races?
Yeah, because it feels like some of the need, unfortunately, right, the need for some of these things in many regards have kind of expired due to multiculturalism and due to many other reasons as well. But it feels like that the tight-knit kind of, township or community is like, it's not there anymore. And I think we've lost something that is so vital. I think in terms of European society, we probably did the best. The early Middle Ages or something like that. It was still tight-knit. The networks were there. We were doing things together. There was also a good dependency on each other. Services were there. It was a good time, I think.
Well, I mean, in terms of, dentistry and medical science and hygiene, it wasn't.
No, I'm not talking about that necessarily, but just in terms of relationships, personal relationships,
yes.
And networks and stuff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, if I could tell you anything, I want people to know that there's trade secrets and cheat codes out there. You just got to look for them, and you'll find them for yourself. I'll give you all of mine for free. But the idea is don't go around thinking that. Don't take the defaults, man. You got to customize your life, big time. If you take the defaults, you'll end up obese, and crawl whimpering to an early grave.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
Society is set up to absolutely destroy people.
Yep.
If they take the defaults. So you got to customize your life. And what I've done is I provided what I could, in 16 years of thinking about how we customize our lives. And really the worst thing is to put the defaults on the children, if you do nothing else but raise children who, not in front of the television, but kind of like the Waldorf system. If you do proper child rearing, you can do no more. Children are a time weapon that you'll launch across the decades.
Well put. Yeah, I definitely want to get into that in more detail
we'll
here later.
Let's finish our merchant discussion, of course. So the merchant thing is, we want to have experts. We want to get rid of failure. We want to minimize failure. If there's any failure that would happen because of a lack of knowledge, we can eliminate that. And, you know, other things, things can fail for other reasons, but you can definitely minimize failure through knowledge.
Yeah. So what else are some of the important things that you've learned along the way that people should know about if they, either if they want to start their own business? I have this thing I want to ask you about later in terms of, you know, kind of networking and maybe on a bigger scale or whatnot. But let's say someone is new, they're just kind of going into it. What else would you recommend them to do to avoid some of the traps and mistakes, perhaps?
Well, you know, to work with the SBDC and...
what is that, for those who don't know?
The Small Business Development Centers.
Yep.
It's the Small Business Association. Set things up the way you're told. Listen to people who know better than you. You know, whether they're in books or actual people giving you advice. Don't run your business on a sentimental way. You got to be like a reptile. Do what's going to work. You got to be Machiavellian. The only thing that matters is what works. Your feels don't matter. Get rid of those feels. You know, you can't, if you're into your feels, man, don't do it. You know, you got to be a reptile. So that's the biggest thing. Because it's not difficult stuff. The thing that's going to mess you up is your own emotions, you know, your own human foibles. And you got to get rid of those. You got to be like a Terminator. You know, you got to be like a robot or a reptile. Just absolutely whatever is going to win, that's what's good, you know.
Yeah, I think we're kind of unaccustomed to that because we have just this idea that people have that incentive towards us, right, that they have that standpoint that somehow they have seen the economic issues and the idea of mercantilism as being used as a weapon against us. I think you said that last time, and it was a good thing. Our mentality is like way back, even before the Middle Ages, almost. As you said, it's we haven't been brought up to speed in terms of how to think, or we haven't realized and wrapped our head around the fact that this is a war that's being waged against us, right?
Yeah, genetically we're Conan the Barbarian, but you know, there's conscious evolution. We don't have to wait for natural selection. We can evolve consciously. We can say, okay, even though, you know, genetically my DNA is Conan the Barbarian, I can learn the trade secrets and cheat codes of the Jews, Hindus, and Chinese, because we're learning creatures, you know, especially if we teach it to our children. We don't have to, you know, we don't have to wait for evolution to happen. We can do conscious evolution. You know, that's what learning is about, man. The learning is the acceleration of evolution.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So.
All right. What else in terms of the merchant? I was interested in this aspect, too, of having some kind of structure in place where there is help across geographical locations and things, that a network, you know?
I would like us to live – I would really like us all to move to Boston, Massachusetts.
Why there?
Massachusetts in particular. Lynn, Massachusetts is it's right on the ocean. There's a really fast internet pipe there, so it would be a great place to have a server hotel. Now, here's a great business we could have. A First Amendment web host.
I have thinking about that too. Absolutely,
yeah.
You're definitely right that somehow someone must offer services that are just don't contain these damn PC clauses and terms and conditions all the time that gets people fired and booted off, you know, their services.
Can you imagine the money we'd make? It would be crazy.
I know, it's exactly, and there would still be able to have a sense of things in terms of like. You know, you wouldn't have to allow, you know, child pornography on there just
so
you would have your sense about these things, obviously, but in terms of, you know, freedom of speech and things that are controversial, no problem, you know?
Right. So, and I know someone in Boston who already runs an ISP, so he knows all the technical stuff of how to do this, and he knows how much it costs to do it. I think he said he would need a startup cost of about $600,000. To do a server hotel, but I mean, it would have a decent chance of making its money. I mean, we would of course do the analysis. And Lynn, Massachusetts has a really fast internet because it comes in right off the ocean, and it's also Lynn, Mass. is a short, like a bus ride and a train ride into downtown Boston. And the reason I want to set up the Merchant Guild in Boston or a city like Boston is because that's where the best educational opportunities for the children are. You know, out in the suburbs, you know, they have the dance schools, they have little music schools, but the quality is really poor. You know, in Boston, if you, you know, they have the best martial arts school, the best music schools, the piano teacher who went to the Moscow Conservatory, you know, the ballet coach from the Bolshoi Ballet in Moscow. You know what I mean? So, and the tutors, you can get tutors from MIT to help your kids with calculus. So that's why I think it's very important we settle somewhere we have access to a city. And Lynn is pretty good. The property values are low enough, you know, and you could buy a few buildings there and set up the families there. And, you know, then you own the business. They work the businesses and they take their kids downtown Boston to go to the Longy School of Music, to go to the Boston Ballet, to go to the art school, to Metropolitan Museum of Art, to go with the Boston Public Library and bring in tutors. And there's plenty of them there. So that's what I see the Guild of Merchants doing, you know, settling a city like that. And
I agree with you, but also check this out, obviously, because if people are in proximity to this area, great. But the fact is, this needs to happen in Europe. It needs to happen in many different locations around the West and the East, where Europeans and, you know, Caucasians are. And also, what's needed is a cooperation between these locations and economy that lets a lot of it in, but not too much goes out, right? We can begin trading with each other, get a hold of resources that are in these different areas, begin operating on a very, very different mentality and level than we do now. That's what's needed here.
Yeah, you know, like the Rothschilds. Mayor Amschel Rothschild got a hold of the fortune of the Elector of Hesse Castle around 1801, and he sent his sons to the five capitals of Europe.
That's right, yeah. That's what the five arrows are all about on his crest or his shield, you know?
Right. And you know, I mean, that's what they got. See, my analogy is white emancipation. What we need is emancipation from political correctness, from being, you know, outlawed politically. Now, the Rothschilds, they actually are probably responsible for Jewish emancipation because there were restrictions on Jewish commercial activities and Jewish involvement in politics. To become a peer in the House of Lords, you had to say upon the oath of a good Christian. Well, Lionel Rothschild got that rule changed in 1848. And it was all because, you know, they did the whole merchant thing. I mean, my idea, I admit, it comes from reading Niall Ferguson's first volume, The House of Rothschild, Money's Profits.
It's
not an original idea. You know, I stole
no.
it.
Well, and also, Rob, you know, I mean, one aspect is, okay, fine, we are being literally pushed out of society, the only societies that we built. But the fact is that that opens up to great opportunity. Why not take that opportunity to build something new, something that actually is much better and also updated, right? Because in the way that we were, we don't want to try to just ape after and then actually, you know, lie several hundred years behind, because I think we have to adapt this to the new times and think ahead of our enemies and our detractors, because if we start adopting a behavior now that they implemented in the 1500s and they're updating along the way, we're still going to be after. If you see what I'm saying, we need to be ahead. We don't need to just kind of create what's already been created, right?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. It's very novel. You know, the idea of, well, you know, you look in society, you got to look at what are society's deficits today, right? And go after those deficits. And if you attack those deficits, it's like investing in Microsoft in 1987.
Right.
The big deficit is child rearing. And so if you raise really strong children, they're going to grow up, they're going to dominate everyone else because the idiocracy is just getting worse and worse and worse. I can't imagine how much worse it's going to be in 20 years, but it's going to be worse.
It
sure
is, yep.
And so, you know, if you raise weaponized children, that they'll get sucked right into the power vacuum. You know, they'll walk right into the leadership roles because nobody else knows what they're doing.
That's absolutely right. Explain that a bit more, what you mean when you say weaponized children.
Okay, so you raise them, they don't get put in front of the television or video games. They do in real life stuff. They're allowed to develop their imaginations. They're like the Waldorf school, but more fashy than the Waldorf school. That's kind of the basic idea.
Yeah.
So the children are overstimulated, right? Modern children, right? And children need to be understimulated. The ideal, like the Waldorf ideal, was having children be like Swiss watchmakers, you know, bent over some, you know, think something doing really precise work, right? And there's something to that. A child who's allowed to develop their mind in an understimulated environment that is just enough that they do things like, and the Waldorf's kids, they do knitting, they do, it's called handwork. I can't think of all the things they have them do, but it's very good.
It's like wood shop and stuff like that, don't they? Like a lot of different things, yeah.
Right. Really precise.
Craftsmanship and yeah.
Yes, and that's what we got. That's the deficit for children. You know, that's the deficit of society right now is good child rearing. So we got to figure out what the best child rearing is. And I'm not going to say I know it right now. I have an idea. I got some ideas, but we're going to have to develop it on our own and, you know, and some trial and error initially. But that's what we got to go after, you know, and have big families ourselves and, you know, and maybe rent a church basement for a homeschool, like a community homeschool and see what works best. You know, start with the Waldorf model and be a little faster than the Waldorf model. Have the kids doing martial arts and gymnastics and playing soccer and stuff and getting out in the woods, you know, running around the woods too, you know, hunting and fishing. You need that as well. And you know, it just anything that's not the TV, you know, it's all got to be real life stuff. And so they can't be overstimulated. You know, they got to have the proper amount of stimulation from the world. And that's, I mean, I think that's the most effective thing we can possibly do. The whole merchant thing is only for that. You know, that's the point of becoming merchants, so that we can have children and raise the children properly.
In an investment in our future. That's what it's about.
High investment parenting.
Yeah.
Is the Microsoft of now.
And also, would you agree, I've been thinking about this too, but this idea of obviously do you want to shield children as much as possible from all the garbage out there, propaganda and stuff like that. But when it comes to TV and stuff like that, you do need a level of them being basically equipped by knowing what it is and what is happening with it, right? You need to like build a firewall of sorts that when this garbage is trying to get into your mind and take you over, children needs to be able to talk about this with their parents. Like that, do let them watch some television, but discuss with them. Take the time.
I'd say when they're teenagers.
Mm-hmm, right.
Not before.
And it's not going to be like an overload for them then and too much that they can't handle that or anything like that. It's not like that.
No, the way TV works is it's only effective if the kids are watching it from a young age. If a 13-year-old watches a TV, you know, for the first time, he's going to get bored with it. If he's been doing real life stuff, right? At first he'll be like very stimulated. Wow, that's amazing, you know. But eventually he's going to realize it's the same shit all the time. So if you help them avoid television in their early life, then their life will be so interesting that TV won't, you know, just they won't even, you know, they'll only watch it in order to be with other people. I mean, I was like that. I got bored with TV. You know, I never watched it alone. I would only watch it in order to be with other people. And honestly, I would have preferred if the other people were doing something besides watching TV, you know, like maybe doing real things.
Were you raised like that in the way that you'd like to raise your own children, or?
No, I wasn't raised. I was put in front of the TV, just like all the other kids.
Oh,
right?
Sorry about that.
But for whatever reason, yeah. I was immune. I was like, this stuff is crap.
I've been thinking about that. You know, why are some kids, they're just immune? Is it genetic? Is it behavior? Is it just the luck of the draw? What is that? It's interesting. You know.
Oh, have you known of other people who were immune?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I am. I mean, I watched TV, but I wasn't, you know, maybe for a short while dragged into it in some way. But as soon as I got into my teenage years, I was like, this is garbage, and I was walking in the different direction, you know.
Right. I sensed something really evil in it. I guess I have a sensitivity to evil.
How do they break that down? Television, Tel Aviv, Zion, evil.
Yeah, right.
It was something like that. I forget what it is.
And also, it was just canned. You know, you knew it was the same thing over and over again. You got bored with it. You know.
Sure. Yeah.
I found books more entertaining. I found going fishing down by the river more entertaining.
It's nothing like being outdoors. Every kid loves that. That's where they want to be. You know, if they could choose, I think.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, I mean, you know, So we got to do the Tiger Mom stuff in the city, but we also got to have, you know, farm in the country. Even if we just find some farmers who let us stay at their place and pay, we pay them some rent and we help them, you know, weed their gardens and stuff and go hunting in their backyard and they'll take us fishing and stuff. Yeah, that'd be great. You know, the rural economy definitely could use that.
So no, like, kind of educating them to, like, build, you know, robots and Terminators and designer viruses and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
Right. The future,
yeah,
right?
Need all of it, yeah. You know. And kids are going to be different. Some are going to be interested in hunting and fishing. Some are going to be more interested in building robots, you know.
Right, diversity. We need true diversity in this regard of talent and difference.
Yeah, once they find an interest, then life is easy. You throw the investment at their interest and let them run with it.
Yeah, yeah. Rob, we're going to take a break here in a little bit. Much more to ask you about when it comes to child rearing and what to do to fight, you know, one of our worst enemies, which is bad parenting. Much more to also actually talk a bit about the parents themselves, what they do wrong, and how we ended up in the way we are now. But is there any? I don't know. Do you have an online presence at all? Is there a way people can get a hold of you for, you know? Obviously, you mentioned that you wanted them to reach out. So tell us about the contacts there.
I post on the Right Stuff forum. I'm Geronimus over there, so you can contact me through chat.
Is that the ideal way? You don't want to give out an email or anything like that?
I could give out. All right. RobWinfield35@gmail.com.
All right, very good. We'll have that up on the website, of course, and so people can get a hold of you easy. Tell us again, just summarize that quick before we take a break. Who are you looking for? Who would you want to reach out to you?
People who are parents and people who want to who are diligent, you know, who have a good work ethic and want to become merchants. You know, and who want to become merchants for the cause, you know, and want to do high investment parenting. You know, even if you don't have a kid yet, you don't have maybe even a wife yet, you know, maybe become a businessman and then you'll be able to have a affordable family. You know, I want you to work with me for affordable family formation and high investment parenting, because then we can launch children as time weapons across the decades, you know. And in 2050, 2060, they deliver their payload. Boom.
All right. Very, very good. Let's talk more about that here after the break. Want to definitely hear more about your ideas, Rob. So stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back. We'll take a short break right here. All right, stay with us. Second hour is coming up with Rob Kievsky. RedIceMembers.com is the website for subscribers and supporters. This is where you can go to acquire a membership with us. Tons of shows in the archives. Please take a look. You don't have to be a member to scroll around. We have much more coming. Next week, we have Frank Jorge from Cuba on Obama's recent visit to Cuba. Should be interesting. We have another 314 show and then a roundtable on Australia and New Zealand as well. Not to be missed, to learn a bit more about what is happening to our friends in the Southern Hemisphere. We'll break right here, and then we'll be back with the second hour with Rob Kievsky. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be right back.